This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Hey, it's Julia Wheeler in conversation with Tommy Barnes.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to the Stamford Travel Writers Festival, and in particular to this event where there is free beer. You will have beer by the end of it. Two glasses, possibly. Welcome to the stage, Tommy.
Thank you very much.
This is a lovely book. This is a lovely book. It's the sort of book that you go back to time and time again. And you almost can't wait to get home to and back on the sofa with a cup of coffee or a beer or some croissant. Let's start at the beginning and talk about push and pull factors. You were living in London in quite a small flat. You were a graphic designer. What pushed you to move?
Well, it was really we were being squeezed out of London. That was the thing, both economically and physically. I was working for a faceless organisation in central London as a second-rate graphic designer. And we were on a pay freeze while everything else was getting more and more expensive. So the flats we could afford were actually getting smaller and smaller to the point where only one of us could sit in the lounge. So it was then that we... But it actually... In fact, it reminded me of this on the way here today. It was a journey on the tube that really made me realise I had to leave. I was on the tube to work one morning. It was rush hour. The tube was packed. I'd managed to get a seat for the first time all year. And I was watching people... We were coming into Oxford Circus. I was watching people on the platform, poised, ready to hurl themselves at the massive bodies in the tube. And I could see the people in the tube with dread on their faces as these people were about to hurl themselves as the door opened. And it reminded me of seals, penguins trying to jump up onto icebergs to escape seals. Most of them would bounce off, but a few would make it. And this is exactly what happened. A couple of people got on. We moved on to the next station where the same thing happened again. And it happened at every single station till we got to my work. But it wasn't that exactly that made me realise we needed to leave. There's a thing in London, when you first move to London, you realise this. When you get on public transport, if there's someone sat on a seat on a busy tube, but there's empty seats both sides of them, that means that person's a lunatic. This is something we all learn very quickly on London transport. And today, I looked round and realised the empty seats were both sides of me. And what I'd been doing was narrating the scene that I'd seen, witnessed on the platform, in the style of David Attenborough, out loud. And I just thought, at that moment, I realised something had to change. It was time to go. So that's what really was the catalyst for me moving out.
You talked about we. Who is your partner in crime here?
My long-suffering wife, Rose, who I met at work. We worked together. So we were... at work, we were offered redundancy. There was a restructure. It seems like a continuous restructure that was going on. And so we just decided to take the money and run. So that's what we did.
And she also... She's not a beer brewer, but she also has a passion of her own outside work, doesn't she?
She's a ceramicist, yeah. She's actually got talent, which is, you know, as a couple, it's good if one of you's got some talent, so yeah.
So why the Loire?
It was chance, really. We decided we were going to tour France and see what places we liked. So we arrived at the first destination was a house in the Loire. And we loved the house. It was owned by an insane woman called Michi. We stayed there for 2 months, rented the house, moved on to the Auvergne, and then around various places in France. But we always loved this first house we stayed in. And then it became... Michi contacted us and told us it was for sale. So we decided to buy it, really. And we knew nothing about the area. It's not a particularly English touristy area. It's not spectacular. But the more you stay there, the more you appreciate the gentle hills. They've got these fantastic wide rivers, chateaus. It's the home of the French chateau, really. Chateaus dot the river along the way, and it just felt comfortable.
Well, the Loire is somewhere that people would go on holiday. I mean, sort of cycle routes and things through there. So people, there are some tourists, aren't there?
There are more and more tourists, but where we are is just slightly away from the really touristy areas.
And how much French did you have?
I had very basic French, GCSE French from, how old am I now? 25 years ago. So not brilliant French.
And did you also have GCSE beer?
I know. I was an expert in drinking beer. I devoted a lot of time to drinking beer of all varieties, but making beer, no, I wasn't. Didn't know much.
So what made you think that you could make a go of it?
My original plan was to move to France, write a best-selling comedy murder mystery, and then spend the rest of my life floating around a swan-shaped swimming pool in a white linen onesie on a giant inflatable flamingo drinking Campari. But I wrote the book, but no one liked it. It was terrible. It was, I think, the worst book ever written. So at that point, I realised I had to do something else. I had to think of a way to make money. So I thought immediately of beer, because beer has always saved me in times of trouble. So
there's a mantra that runs through this, which is, it'll probably be all right. Did that start at that stage?
I really live my life by that mantra, and it's produced fairly underwhelming results. Once we moved there, people often say to me, oh, you're very brave to have given up a perfectly good job in London, gone and changed your life to something you knew nothing about. But I think really there are two sorts of people that do that. There are people like my wife who think through all the problems, all the risks, and then do it anyway. They're brave people. And then there are people who don't really give any thought at all. People who think it will probably be all right. And those people are idiots. And that's what I did.
So you got to France, you've bought your house, and there's pictures in the book. It is a beautiful house. It's a sort of dream noir place, isn't it? How do you set about setting up a brewery in a place which, let's be honest, is more known for wine?
Yeah, it's a big wine area. It's famous for Chinon red wines. So I started with a very small brewery, about 25 litres, about a metre high.
When you say a brewery, what does that look like? What is it made up of?
This one in particular was a sort of all-in-one brewery. So to a quick recap of brewing, you have three vessels, a boiler to boil water, a mash tun to mix your malt, and then a kettle where you add your hops and things. But this was I call it a cuvée because I'm a French now. It's a cylinder, and you make beer in this very small cylinder, and it's very clever. You can do everything in one cylinder. So I started in that with fairly poor results. Brewed for about a year with this small cylinder, and I got to the point where I thought my beers were getting to be all right. So I then sourced a brewery from North West Wales, a bit larger, a 400 litres brewery, so that would fill a sort of a small room.
And so how much can you make? If you were working at that full-time in a week, how many bottles, how many litres would that generate?
I make about 1,200 litres a month, which is about 6,000 small bottles a month. And I drink about half of them and sell the rest.
So when you're starting out, who did you test your beer out on apart from yourself?
I started out testing it on my neighbour, Damien, who's I think the most French person you could possibly meet. He's a very friendly guy, but thinks the English are insane, and I've done nothing to disavow this. He's not a big beer drinker. And he was very frank in his criticisms of my beer, and still is. So I would test them out on him. I was started off making IPAs. That's what I'm interested in. I don't know if you know much about beer, but IPAs are a sort of an English style with lots of hops.
And IPA is Indian Pale Ale.
Indian Pale Ale, yeah. But where we live, the French generally drink blonde beers, lagers, and Belgian beers. So I made IPA for about a year. Damien told me over and over again it was too bitter. The French don't like bitterness. And to make a blonde beer. I ignored him for a year, finally started brewing a blonde beer, and it's now my bestseller.
So funny that.
Yeah. So I named it after him, and he wasn't impressed with that either. But.
And you sold it all in France?
I sell it all in France, yeah. I don't have an export license to sell in the UK. So, yeah, all in France.
Okay, so why don't we taste some of that beer, I think?
Yeah.
Should we start with the IPA, and then people can perhaps see the difference between that one and not?
Yeah.
So that's the IPA, is it?
No, this is
the
IPA.
Sorry, that's
the
IPA.
Yeah, it's a cloudy IPA. It's supposed to be cloudy. And if it wasn't, I'd still tell you it was supposed to be cloudy. So,
tell us how this brewing process, in terms of what's gone into it, differs from this one.
It's hops, really. In the biscuit beer, the other beer, I use maybe 400 grams of hops. In the IPA, I use about 8 kilograms of hops. So it's double, yeah, I don't know, a lot more. Yeah.
Okay. And where do those raw materials come from? Have you had to import them? Have you been able to get them locally?
I get the malt from fairly locally. Beer is made of malt, hops and yeast, effectively. And the hops I get from the Alsace and from Germany.
And is that important to you, that you can get some things locally? And is it important to the French in terms of provenance?
It is, yeah. The French are very proud of their local produce, more so than the English, I think. So in every supermarket, there'll always be large sections of regional food, and every French region thinks that they have the best food. And the best drink. And so I use local honey in my beer, which I think draws people in. It's very important that people think it's from the area.
And so what stage does the honey go in then?
The honey goes in the what's known as the boil, when you're first brewing the beer. And then that's the sugar's fermented out.
Mm. I think in the book it's fair to say that you do have a fair few disasters.
I continue to have disasters.
Okay.
I flood the brewery about once a week. Very regularly. I would. Somebody once described watching me in the brewery as like watching a montage of Homer Simpson, which I thought was nice. Yeah, I remember my very first brew. There's a stage in the brew which is called the hot break, which is where proteins rise up from the brew as it's boiling, and if you're not careful, they'll spill over the top, and you'll have this sort of sticky boiling liquid. I think I describe it as like napalm all over the brewery. So I was very aware of this, my first brew. I was keeping a close eye on it. I have two dogs. I should mention the dogs, actually. I have two dogs, Louis, who's a lovely dog, and Bert, who I'm fairly sure is some representation of Beelzebub. But I heard a noise outside as I was brewing, waiting for the hot break. It was like a Gatling gun. I went out to see what it was. It was one of my dogs had found the malt and had been eating it and had promptly started throwing up in a sort of a Gatling gun pattern across the garden, then running over and eating the vomit. So I charged out after this dog. I was in my underpants at this time. I didn't mention that. I did my first brew in my underpants. Some kind of connection to nature I thought was important. So I ran out into the garden in my underpants, grabbed the dog, who was still throwing up like a machine gun, and tried to take him away. My other dog ran round behind me, started eating the first dog's vomit.
Oh.
So my first dog slipped out of my hand. I grabbed the second dog. The first dog went back to eat the vomit. I slipped in the mud on this vomit, became covered in malt and mud in my underpants, finally managed to get the dogs, chuck them over the fence where there was a gate so they couldn't get to my malt. Went back into the brewery to find I missed the hot break, and the entire brewery was covered in this sort of it's a yellowy, hot, smelly goo, I would say.
not living the dream, really.
No, and it hasn't really got better from there.
Well, has the beer got better? Who do we have? Beer connoisseurs? We get yes.
If there is a
drop, that would be lovely. Thank you.
I hear the brew is excellent.
Thank you, beer connoisseurs in the audience. I'm getting the thumbs up from over there. Yeah. Tasty, like it? Okay, so that's the IPA, and we'll send round some of the biscuit in a second.
This chap wants a photo of the bottle, so you've already...
Oh, right, we're there.
Well, let's talk about the bottles, because, I mean, quite a lot of it is about the marketing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the labels and the shape of the bottles and so on and so forth. So how did you come up with that brand?
The brand came very naturally, really. As I say, I was a second-rate graphic designer in London before I moved over to France. But I'm really pleased with it. It's the best graphic design I've ever done, I think, because my heart was in it. You know, it was about beer, so I actually really put some effort in. And so I wanted the brand to be a sort of a French bistro style, gold lettering on a window. So that's where that came from.
And the name is... The village.
The name's the village where we live, Braloo. Yeah, it's a silent S.
And what sort of place is that? How much of a community is there? And
Braloo's brilliant. It's a proper village. It's a working village. There are touristy villages around us, which are very picturesque. But in winter, they just die because all the tourists leave and all the people with second homes leave. Braloo's a proper village. It's farmers and tradesmen and yeah, but everyone's lovely. Everyone's really, really friendly there.
And how easy or difficult have you found it to integrate, and what has made the difference?
Well, beer, Julia, has made
the
difference, yeah. I give people beer on a regular basis. You'd be amazed what that does.
That works the world over.
Yeah, it does. It really does.
Even the rubbish beer?
The rubbish beer, yeah, this was a beer I made... When I first got my big brewery, my first beer I made, I had a big festival. I had to make lots of beer for this festival. It was the first time I used a brewery. I was using these big old plastic fermenters, which had scratches in. And the problem with scratches is bacteria can live in the scratches, and then that can ruin your beer, which is exactly what happened. And I made a beer which tasted distinctly of bin. The bin juices you get around the that was effectively the beer. It was alcoholic, so it wasn't all bad. And so I had to make a decision whether to sell the beer and potentially ruin my reputation, or just scrap the beer and try again. But at the time, we needed the money, so I sold the beer and have been trying to rebuild my reputation ever since. Yeah. Actually, that's not true. The people are really forgiving there. They love, as we said earlier, they love if you're making something yourself. They love something that's local. And so, I mean, they should have. Some of the beers I made were awful. And they should have disowned me. But instead, they supported me. The mayor's a big supporter. And now they like the beer. I get lots of good feedback from people.
I guess the difficulty is you're making something and you don't know how it's going to taste until... the end.
That's the problem with beer. Yeah. If you're impatient like me, it's a nightmare because you really need to wait for it. It takes 4 weeks roughly to make a beer from start to finish, four to 5 weeks, and you don't really know if it's any good till it's been bottled and it's ready. Mm-hmm.
So, tell us about some of your neighbours. You've mentioned Damien. So, how did he help you?
Well, Damien's my chief tester and chief critic, both of beer and my lifestyle and general life choices. Then I have Monsieur Richard, who is an elderly Frenchman who lives opposite us, who has what I would describe as the Sistine Chapel of gardens. He's immaculate. The man's incredible. His favourite words are impec, which is sort of impeccable, and prop, which means clean or proper. So everything he does is perfect. He's the exact antithesis of me, which made me think he would probably hate me, but actually he's one of my biggest supporters. I mean, just that he doesn't judge us is incredible. He comes around and sees our house with the dogs digging holes in the garden, and we've got a miniature horse, a very angry miniature horse, which is possibly some kind of a sexual predator. a Cameroonian lamb, two dogs, as I say, one is a Beelzebub, and just a general sort of catastrophe and that you have with two young children and lots of animals you don't know how to train.
And it's Rose, isn't it, who's kind of been the herder, if you like, of these animals. She's been the one that's driven that.
Yeah, our first animals arrived, the dogs arrived, I thought, of part of her pregnancy cravings. She was pregnant at the time. She suddenly wanted dogs. We got dogs. Then the miniature horse arrived. So I thought that was probably her pregnancy cravings again, but we'd already had the baby by this point, which was strange. Then a Cameroonian lamb arrived. Again, by now I was thinking maybe it wasn't the pregnancy cravings. In that time, we also had chickens. Bert ate the chickens. Bert's a dog. And we had two sheep as well. And we had a goat that was a misogynist, so we had to get rid of him.
And how has Rose's work gone in terms of the ceramics?
Rose is, she makes animal sculptures, which is probably why we got all the animals.
Yeah.
She's been doing really well, but we've got two children now. We've got a young baby, so at the moment she's not doing much. But we've got a little studio out the back of the house now. The thing about buying a house in France like this is you've got so much space compared to our flat in London, which had, I think, one a bedroom and a living room, which was sort of also the kitchen, and no balcony. We've now got, I think, maybe an acre of land. We've got outbuildings, and all for much cheaper. You know, that's really the big advantage of selling up and moving there. So we've got a studio in the back of the house for Rose to make her ceramics.
So let's go back to the marketing side of things. How do you actually sell your beer? Do people come to you? Do you go to people? Have you got it supplied into different places?
I at the moment I supply to the local bars and shops. I do the market, the local Richelieu market, which is the local town, which is brilliant. I love doing the market. And people come to the brewery as well. The market's great for my French. I now have a sort of functional tradesman's French, I think. It's very enjoyable.
And is it the same people who come back again and again?
I have regulars. I have a little gang of elderly French women who come each week to buy my stout. And I don't know why. I've never got to the bottom of it. I don't know if it's if they're cooking with it or they use it for some kind of potion. I don't know, but they're there every week to buy it.
And so how does stout get made differently than to the IPA or the blonde beer?
It's malt, really. You use malts which are kilned longer, so they're effectively burnt more, which makes them dark, and that gives the dark flavour to the beer,
okay.
the dark colour.
And so that then will take 4 weeks to go through the whole brewery, or is it that you're at different stages and so you can have a few on the go?
Yeah, you have a few. It takes a week to ferment the beer. It takes a day to make the beer, to make what is called your wort, which is your sugary liquid, which you then want to ferment. You put it in fermenters. That takes a week to ferment. Or up to 2 weeks to ferment.
And then you can put something else in the first part.
Then you can restart again after a week.
Okay.
You move the beer from the fermenters to storage. Then you bottle the beer. I bottle traditionally, so I bottle condition, which means it re-ferments in the bottle, so you create natural gas from the bottle. That takes around 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
And then it's ready to go?
And then it's ready to get you drunk.
Right. Do we have any home brewers in the audience? Anybody who's... okay. And over here. So are these things that you're learning as well as drinking?
Well, you probably know it.
Yeah. Are you ready for another round? Are you ready for some... some of the blonder beer? You always are, Roddy. Yeah. So what should we know about this one?
This beer is a sort of Belgian amber beer, really. Where we are, the French are much more used to Belgian beers than English beers. So it's quite a strong beer, quite malty. It's got lots of honey in it. It's a completely different style.
So the older French ladies are buying the stout. Who's buying this?
This, I sell this to the French, the local French, really, this beer. The IPA sells more to tourists in summer, and the biscuit beer sells more to the local French.
And those tourists, they're Brits mostly, or
a lot of
elsewhere?
Brits now, yeah. More and more Brits, yeah, coming over. Too many. No, I'm joking. But yeah, too many.
Do you have neighbours who are also, what do you call yourself, expat or?
Not neighbours, but in the next village there are expats. There are quite a few, yeah.
And are they people that you've been drawn to, or have you not exactly tried to avoid? Have you tried to really
fair,
integrate?
Yeah, yeah. There are two sorts of expats. There are expats that come over and try to integrate and try to become part of the culture, learn the language. And then there are expats that sit outside the cafe in Richelieu complaining about immigration and people in England not learning the language, and they don't speak a word of French. So we try and avoid those sort of expats.
Are you polite?
Yeah, oh yeah, always, yeah. I try and sell beer. You've got to be diplomatic. Yeah, sure.
I think it should probably be on already, actually, yeah. And we have to get onto the B word because it's potentially going to affect you. So how do you think things potentially could change depending on the political situation? And what's the reaction of those people who are like you, expats?
Well, if it's a really bad outcome, we're going to go into hiding. We're going to hide in a car.
From the French,
yeah, I think, who come and deport us. We're hoping we'll be all right, but I mean, the French think we're mad, I think. The thing is, the French like the English, really. They may not admit it, but they like us. They think we're mad, but there's a sort of a brotherly love. And so they're just really disappointed, I think. They don't understand why we want to leave. But I put it down to a classically British thing. I think, whereas the French and the Italians would get very angry about things and express it and vent their anger, the Germans would think through some kind of logical solution to their anger. The British are angry about a lot of things, but what we've done is repress it and repress it and repress it until it's exploded and we've lashed out at something which I think possibly we didn't want to do.
Which isn't necessarily the thing that we're angry at.
Which would not necessarily will fix what we're angry at, yeah.
And so do you sit down and talk to the French over a beer about this? Or actually, is it easier to avoid the conversation?
We talk about it, yeah. The markets and things, people are interested. But, yeah, I don't know. They do. A lot of them don't really know. They still think David Cameron's the Prime Minister. So it doesn't get very deep.
Well, probably a lot of us still think Mitterrand's the President.
Yeah, well,
so
yeah.
Fair enough. Right, yeah. What do we think of this beer? I'm going to go to the experts. Which one's your favourite? Okay, so first or second ones for you? Mm. Which? Second one. Okay. Okay, I'm going to have it. That's that one. I'll have a taste too. Yeah, no, I'm with the second one as well.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Lovely. So tell us about your fire engine.
Well, I had to buy a van to go to the markets. And so what I should have done was buy a modern sort of Ford Transit with a good service history, but instead I found a 1982 Peugeot G9, which is a sort of looks like a ladybird on wheels.
It's possibly
the worst of designed van.
On the book you can get a sense of the shape of it.
The wheels are much too close to the centre, so if you go over a bump it rocks like a boat. But it looks good. My thinking was it will attract people at the market. And on the days it makes it to the market, that is absolutely the case. So I think it was a good buy. But I bought it from Burgundy, which is should be a 6-hour drive away. Everyone told me not to buy it, but I did. Everyone told me not to try and drive it home 6 hours, but I did. Even the man who I bought it from, who had assured me before this that it was mechanically sound, when I told him I was going to drive it 6 hours, told me I must be mad. But I did it anyway, and it made it. It took me 12 hours, because it doesn't like going faster than 70 kilometres an hour. What's that? I don't know, about 40 miles an hour, I think.
And you've got the engine up front with you, haven't you?
I've got the...
The engine up
front. The engine's actually in the cabin where the passenger seat should be, which I thought was crazy until I realised it's a very good way of finding out if the engine's overheating or not, which it does on a regular basis. It was an X-Fire engine, so it was a sort of a... It's got lights on, it's still got a working siren in case there's a beer emergency.
It is the siren, really, isn't it, that attracted you?
It's absolutely that. I'm a child. I'm a child in a small, tubby man's body. And, it's exactly that. And I love more than driving through the village with the siren on to the chagrin of the grumpy French elderly men who stare at me.
They love you, I'm sure.
maybe on some level. We haven't found that level yet. But.
Tell us about the Gallic shrug. Oh, first of all, let's see your Gallic shrug.
Oh, you've got a sort of a...
Should we all have a little...
There's a noise that goes with it.
Right. So
there's a few noises that we don't have in England that the French make. But that's... Yeah, bah. Bah.
What does it mean?
Well, the Gallic shrug is a very useful tool, I realised. I'll give you an example. The first time I really got caught in a Gallic shrug sandwich was I had a problem with a car. The battery wouldn't charge. So I went to the local mechanic. He said, you need a new battery. So I went and bought a new battery. The car still didn't charge. So the mechanic said the battery was faulty. So I went to the man in the battery shop. He, instead of giving me a new one, he gave me a Gallic shrug. Just went, boh, like that. So I went back to the man in the garage, and he said, no, the battery's definitely faulty, it's nothing else. So I went back to the man in the battery shop. He refused to change my battery, gave me another Gallic shrug, went back to the man in the mechanics, and he just gave me a Gallic shrug, boh, like that. And the thing about it is, it's hypnotising. I was back in my car driving home when I suddenly realised there'd been no solution to this thing. They're just the Gallic shrug. It's almost like a... And so you just go, oh, OK, I'll just go. And so, so I found myself in this Gallic shrug sandwich, and the car to this day hasn't been fixed.
So there is no solution, or actually it's that you don't need a solution.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just...
How have you found the bureaucracy side of things, given that you're setting up a business?
It's extraordinary, the bureaucracy in France. It's an art form. When I first started setting up the business, I emailed an office I thought I had to go and register with to become a... I was doing a bit of gardening and a bit of brewing at the time. And so I went to this office. I'd emailed them previously saying what I wanted to do. The man welcomed me in, sat me down, asked me what I wanted to do. I said I wanted to do gardening. He went, oh, brilliant, OK. Checked his computer and said, yeah, no, you've come to the wrong office. And I said, well, but I emailed you this. And he said, yeah, well, you've come to the wrong office. Is there anything else I can help you with? So I said, well, I'd like to do a bit of brewing as well. I emailed you this. So he said, oh, yeah, yeah. Checked his computer and went, yeah, no, you've still come to the wrong office. So so I walked away, and I just thought that there must be, like, offices and offices in France just dedicated to telling you you've come to the wrong office. It's hard. It's being a second language, it's hard as well, trying to negotiate through bureaucracy.
You mentioned gardening, and I wonder whether people who have an idea of going to a place and living the dream and so on and so forth need to have an openness to a backup, because gardening wasn't something that you either loved or had done very much of, but you found that you were having to compromise a little bit.
Yeah, when I moved, I made a statement I regretted, saying that I would do anything to bring the money in. And gardening's easy work. You don't have to, depending on if you're doing what I was doing, you didn't have to be particularly skilled. But I realised there's two sorts of gardeners. There's those who giveth life, and there's those who taketh away. And I was the sort of gardener who tooketh away. Gardening shouldn't be that difficult, but I hacked my way through countless hedges, gardens. I remember someone asked me to put this stuff on the lawn to kill the moss, but I wasn't listening. I put loads of it on, and it ended up looking like the surface of the moon. I just destroyed their lawn in one fell swoop. People were quite forgiving. I don't know why. Probably I gave them beer. I think that was what it was.
Do you find that lots of the people that you've met have had to have this second string to their bow?
Yeah, I think so. People often work several jobs, and there's lots of people who are handy. You find that everyone in the countryside is handy. They will do a lot of DIY. They'll turn their hand to things, and the British I know out there are the same. Really, they often work several jobs.
And you've done some of your own DIY, which has kind of become a bit of a local attraction, hasn't it?
Yeah, I built the worst fence in Bralou, which I think is its official title now. And people, French farmers, would come to stop to admire the handiwork
of the
fence.
Of it.
Yeah, it would. If the wind blew, the entire fence would sway and ripple from one end all the way around to the other. And then we had to knock down part of the wall as we were building the brewery. So I rebuilt it. And that is now officially the worst wall in Bralou as well. And people would come to see that.
Building up a collection.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's get the microphone out. And if anybody's got a question, either about moving to another country or about beer or about anything that you've heard or another thing. Yeah, let's have a question over here.
Hello. Yeah, that's it. Tommy, I came across a hazelnut beer in South Korea. Any thoughts on using any type of nut at all? Is that something unique or any thoughts on that, please?
I haven't got any plans to use nuts in beer. I'm going to experiment with putting eau de vie in beer. The beauty of beer is you can put anything in it. I mean, unless you're in Germany where they have very strict laws, they may have repealed them now, but most places you can put anything in beer, and for that reason, if you go to Belgium, for instance, you'll find all sorts of nuts, herbs, I don't know, cement, who knows? So I don't have any plans at the moment, but I'm open to really anything like that. My biggest problem at the moment is I bought 8,000 labels for my bottles. And so I have to, with the ingredients on, so I have to only make those beers until the labels run out, and then I can make something different. Mm. Yeah.
Other questions? A question over here.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi. Good to see you. Yeah. I think I was a bit put off your book at the start because I thought it was going to be just like Peter Mayle's A Year in Provence, which I quite enjoyed at the time, and I thought it was going to be a repeat. But actually, I haven't finished the book, but it's very much you, and it is entertaining, so I find it quite a good book.
Thank you.
What I wanted to ask you is, you just touched a moment ago about German purity laws and what you thought about making beer with just malt and water, which is a German purity thing, and you can add hops. But if you make beer that way, you can call it a health drink, which puts a different slant on it. And the other point I wanted to ask you, is your beer just for men? Because Brass Low is a bit sexist, isn't it?
Brass Low. Bra-low?
Brass Low? Brass Low? Brass Low?
Brass Low. I like bras. Is that it?
You read the name of Brass Low, you can also read it as Brass Low.
Brass Low.
Yeah, I didn't get that. Let's have a chat about that after.
Yeah, the German purity laws are that you can only make beer with malt, hops, and water. But I think they've now opened that up. But originally it wasn't so much to keep the beer pure as to make sure people were using the right grains, I think, because they didn't want to use wheat for beer, they wanted to use it for bread. But in terms of making a beer as a health drink, I mean, I think it's a health drink anyway, you know. I think
the point is not to use sugar and yeast.
Oh, they use yeast, but they don't use sugar.
You don't have to.
Well, you have to have yeast to ferment the beer, otherwise it won't ferment.
There's yeast in the air. That's how you make sourdough.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
bread.
Yeah. Well, the Belgians make a beer with, I forget the name of it, a sour beer using yeast from the air. So they don't use yeast that you buy in a packet. But it's still, I mean, it's still yeast. It's still doing the same process, turning the sugar into alcohol. I tell people my stout is good for the health because so I think in the 1950s they recommended pregnant women drink stout. I think it's long since disproven, but you know they don't know that in France, so that's fine.
These things hang around. Any other questions about beer or France? Anybody planning a trip to the Loire? There's a chap at the back there who wants some highlights, perhaps.
You say the French think we're mad. Is that generally, or is that over the B word?
Generally, I think. They think we're... Well, actually, not all of them think we're crazy to leave the EU. There's a big French movement to leave the EU as well, but I think a lot of French people... they think we're mad generally, but in a sort of a... in a quite a quaint way, you know. There they go, the British flooding their brewery again, and, you know...
and eating roast beef.
They're very... traditional French are very regimented in the way they live. Everything has its place. A beer, for example, is normally an aperitif. You'll have a glass of beer before your meal. Or if it's a very hot day, you'll have a glass of beer. But you won't go to Wetherspoons at 11 a.m. and walk out, you know, when it shuts, like we all do on a regular basis. If you do things in a different way, they think you're mad. Yeah.
Any other questions? One just here.
Hi, can you hear me? Yeah. Do you collaborate with other brewers? In the UK, there's now thousands of microbreweries, and a lot of the small folk started by collaborating with other people. I know there are a couple of micros in Normandy, but what's your take on collaboration?
Well, I was contacted only last week by... a brewer in England, actually, who wants to collaborate. So we're going to do our first collaboration there. And I've just started meeting the other brewers around. So I'd be very open for that. I think it's great. The thing about brewers is they're always friendly because they're normally drunk. So we get on very well.
I get the impression that you don't have any or many regrets, but I wonder when you look back at this process of leaving London and going to the Loire and the things that you've had to do to be successful, how do you think it's changed you?
Oh, God. Well, it's changed me quite significantly. I realised that, I mean, when I was in London, I was stagnating and I'd really, lost the will to live is a strong word, but I didn't really have any ambition. I wasn't ever going to do anything. Now you realise that if you really just get up and do something, you can do it, even if it's just a really crap version of what you wanted to do. You have actually done it, you know, and then the next time, you'll make it a bit better and a bit better. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'd write a self-help book next. How about that? We'll do, yeah.
That's great. Lovely. Thank you very much, Tommy. That's a real inspiration in beer terms and travel terms and just get up and get out there. Persevere. Thank you so much for coming and for tasting the beer, and thank you for some great questions. Tommy's going to be over in the book stand there. It's honestly a lovely book. Go and read it. It's got beer recipes, it's got life, it's got a little bit of everything in there for everybody. So do go and carry on the conversation and have a chat with Tommy over there. Thanks for coming. Thank you, Tommy Barnes.
Thank you.